The 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It's Donal Kavanagh with you on till 12 noon today. As ever, a lot to get through, but as we always say, the absolute heart of this programme is your views, your perspectives, your take on the news of today and the issues you want to see and hear discussed. You can contact us via text or WhatsApp on 086 60 25000. You can call us on 074 91 25000. Caroline producing and taking your calls, Niamh taking your calls as well this morning. You can use the 00353749125000 code if you're dialing from outside of the Donegal area. If you wish to contact us via social media, it's at Highland Radio on Twitter or X, Highland Hub on Facebook. We're also on other social media platforms, and you can watch the show unfold on our Facebook pages and also on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. As ever, we will begin with a look at the newspapers on this Tuesday morning, the 26th of September. Don't forget, by the way, because it's a Tuesday, we will have our Gartha slot coming up after the news at 10. That's at about 10 past 10 or so, when we will be giving you the chance to help Gardaí with a number of incidents and appeals that have happened around the area over the past 7 days. We'll begin our newspaper review this morning with the Tuesday Donegal Democrat and the main headline, tributes paid to Precious Ronan. The 9-year-old boy who was tragically killed in a hit and run in Bundoran on Saturday was Ronan Wilson. There's quotes there from the GAA Wolf Tones Club. We spoke to their chair yesterday. Obviously, it went to press too late last night for the update that a man has been charged and is due in court shortly. And Gardaí are appealing for more information on that particular horrific collision. Also on the front, interesting one, major revamp planned for Biddy's Bar as part of a major Glencullum Kill development. The bar in Glencullum Kill there, a three-storey building to include accommodation and a transport hub, could be constructed on an adjacent site, we're told. Also on page three, children traumatised as speeding truck hits curb at Duncanneely School. You heard that discussed in detail on the programme last week with Greg. A number of people who were present on the day spoke to Greg about their experience, and by all accounts that was a potentially horrific situation that developed in Duncanneely last week. I beg your pardon. Looking at the Nationals, the Irish Independent this morning, 1 in 8 homes now in arrears on their energy bills. There has been a huge spike in the number of households getting into arrears on electricity and gas bills. Figures from the regulators show that 256,000 residential electricity customers, that's 1 in 8, were in arrears in the 3 months to June. That's an increase of almost 55,000 compared with the first 3 months of the year. Also, Larry ready to embrace Ryder Cup challenge. We saw the ladies show the way with the Solheim Cup at the weekend and a fantastic comeback from them, led in no small part by Leona Maguire. And can the men emulate the ladies' success and take the Ryder Cup? Well, they're all arriving in Rome. Nice picture of Shane Lowry greeting Rory McIlroy ahead of the next couple of days' competition. Also, two arrested as trawler suspected of carrying drugs runs aground. Two men have reportedly been arrested after a trawler suspected to be carrying a large consignment of cocaine ran aground off the County Wexford coast. Irish Times this morning. Main headline is lower tax rate considered for landlords. Fraught pre-budget negotiations made worse by expected €1 billion health overspend. Concerned big health hike would mean fewer spending increases for other departments. Now, landlords could be paying less tax on rental incomes in an effort to persuade them to stay in the market under proposals put forward in advance of budget talks intensifying this week. Now, that's an interesting one because on the one hand, they feel they do need to bring in measures to attract more landlords into the system. On the other hand, many, many people potentially facing eviction, many, many people facing huge rent increases will look at landlords to get tax breaks, and that will evoke a very, very different reaction from them. And as I said yesterday, I certainly don't envy Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath as they try to bridge a number of gaps and try to square a number of circles and reconcile a number of contradictions when they are drawing up the budget, which is to be presented in the coming weeks. Both suspected of carrying cocaine runs aground. More details on the Search is continuing today in the waters off Wexford following the discovery of what Gardaí believe to be a large consignment of cocaine on board a boat which ran aground. The vessel got into difficulty on Sunday night near Blackwater. The rescue and surveillance operation continued into the early hours of the morning. Two men were winched to safety and brought onto a naval service vessel. It's understood a number of people were rescued from the water. They're all being questioned by Gardaí in County Wexford at the moment. Looking at the Irish Daily Mail, alarm grows at Garda watchdog office break-in. Demand for full disclosure over incident and security of sensitive files. John Lee writes that whistleblowers and politicians have called for full disclosure into a break-in at the Garda Watchdog's headquarters. The break-in at the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission GSOC offices took place earlier this month, and it's understood a number of people with highly sensitive files in the Garda in GSOC's possession have written to the body seeking information about the matter. Labour Party TD and former Minister Alan Kelly has tabled a number of questions this week seeking information from the Justice Minister Helen McEntee about the incident, and I strongly suspect that we are going to see more and more on that story. That has the look to me of one of these stories that starts off small but becomes huge, and I think that's going to become really big in the days to come. Irish Daily Mirror, new allegations, brand, sex assault claims grow. Scotland Yard has opened a probe into several claims of sexual assault into Russell Brand. The Met said it has received a number of allegations in London and from across the UK about the star. It added detectives have launched an investigation into allegations of sexual offences. No arrests have been made and Brand denies all the claims. Also, IRA bomb victim's father backs rugby fans singing Zombie, but not the players. A lot of debate I noticed yesterday on national media about the fact that Zombie was played at the end of the Ireland-South Africa match in Paris on Saturday night. And the crowd, it has to be said, were singing along with gusto. And there is a lot of coverage on this. And the quote from Colin Parry, whose son Tim was killed in Warrington along with 3-year-old Jonathan Bell. He said he doesn't want the team using it as their anthem. He says, I think probably many of the fans singing have no idea of its origins or what it's about. And the song Zombie, written by Dolores Riordan after the Warrington atrocity, of course. And those of us of an age will well remember that atrocity and the aftermath of it. Irish Sun this morning, similar story to the earlier one from the Mirror. Cops probe Brand sex assault. Cops last night confirmed they're investigating fresh claims of sexual assault against Russell Brand. Very similar there. Also, Keelty's figures drop by a third. Patrick Keelty's Late Show ratings fell by a third for his second episode in charge. Some 548,000 people tuned in to see guests, including Vogue Williams, down from the average of 830,000 who watched his debut a week earlier. Look, that was always going to happen. That was always going to happen. The first Late Late Show with Patrick Keelty, everyone, you know, myself included, let's be honest, I watched it. And I usually would not watch the Late Late Show much. I will maybe catch up on stuff on the RTE player later if I hear there was an interesting guest on. But by and large, on a Friday night, I would not be watching the Late Late Show. So I made a point of staying in and watching it the week before because I wanted to see how Keelty did on his first. And I think a lot of people will have. No one could base anything on the first episode. I think really to make a judgment on Patrick Keelty and what figures he's going to get, what you really have to do is wait until about four episodes in. And then at that stage, tabulate your numbers 2, 3 and 4. That'll give you an idea. The first one was always going to be inflated because a lot of people were going to be looking in out of curiosity. Would he say anything about the RTE controversies? Which he did. And in fairness, I thought naming the band Grant Thornton and the Flip Flops was a particularly nice comedic touch. But, you know, it was always going to fall. And, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, that it dropped by a third. I mean, I would almost say that to actually keep the drop at only 33%, I think was actually quite good. In my view, because it was always going to be a hugely inflated figure for his first. As for me, last Friday, I was in Strabane. I was in the alley in Strabane watching the Seeger Sessions revival, and what a show. I mean, let's be honest about it. Patrick Keelty could have brought a flying saucer down from Mars and interviewed E.T. on the programme, and it wouldn't have been as good as what we experienced in the alley on Friday night. And the Irish Daily Star this morning, €140 million snowstorm. Clever headline. Two men have been arrested after a fishing trawler with an estimated €140 million worth of cocaine on board ran aground amidst high winds in Wexford on Sunday night. And again, UK police probe more sex assault claims against Brand. And Bomb Boy's dad backs... Bomb Boy's dad backs Irish fans. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I'm all for an alliterative headline and for preciseness, and I understand what tabloids have to do when it comes to their headlines, but Bomb Boy's dad, I'm not sure I would have phrased it that way. Now, let's talk about the health service, because Sinn Féin are launching their alternative health budget, setting out the party's plan to reform the health service in a Sinn Féin-led government. And we're joined on the line by Deputy David Cullinan, who is the Sinn Féin spokesperson on health. Deputy Cullinan, good morning.
Good morning, Donald.
First things first, we're told that at this point in time, as we speak, as Ministers McGrath and O'Donoghue sit down to figure out their spending priorities and what they can afford to do in Budget 2024, the health service is $1 billion over budget already. Is that something that you're factoring into your own discussions and your own deliberations?
Well, we have had meetings with the senior officials in the Department of Health and the HSE in preparations for our budget. And unfortunately, we can't get an actual figure on what the overrun will be. So, yes, we will make a provision, but it has to be based on whatever figures are in the public domain or figures that we get from the department. There is a much wider problem, and that last year I predicted exactly this would happen. So in our alternative budget last year, we proposed a package of measures of €1.2 billion to ensure that hospitals had the capacity that they needed. We know that the trolley crisis and the pressures in emergency departments are all year round. We know that part of the problem in emergency departments is a lack of alternative care pathways, for example, Edinburgh's GP care, which I know is an issue in Donegal and in other rural areas as well. So we had set out a very ambitious but realistic plan on putting those investments in last year. The government provided just €300 million of additional spend, and now we're looking at about €1 billion of a shortfall. So we've been proven right that those investments were necessary. I also pointed out to the Minister for Health, because it's not all about additional investment. We also need to reform how we spend our money. There are hospitals that are doing exceptionally well and have had no patients on trolleys now for a long time. That needs to be the case in more hospitals, and we have to mandate that best practice. But equally, we're spending huge amounts of money on outsourcing, on agency, on management consultancy, and a whole range of areas where it's only in recent weeks now that the head of the HSE is putting in place cost containment measures to try and control those costs. So there are lots of things that need to be done. It isn't all just about making investments. Yes, they are necessary. But equally, it's about containing runaway costs in certain areas that can be contained, but also making the reforms to ensure that we get bang for buck for the money that we are investing in healthcare.
The comment you made about the trolleys is an interesting one, because Argyll Hospital in Waterford has had a record of zero or next to zero patients on trolleys in the emergency department for quite some time now. Letterkenny is regularly in the 20s, 30s and sometimes even higher. It can be in the top five in the country, indeed third highest in the country yesterday. Sligo also tends to be up and around about the top five. What's the difference between what's happening in Waterford versus what's happening in Letterkenny and Sligo, that Waterford can manage to return zero patients on trolleys day after day after day?
Well, I've been tracking what's been happening in University Hospital Waterford since I first got involved in politics, and I've seen very similar problems that exist in Galway and Limerick and in some hospitals in Dublin. It used to be the case in Waterford. So it isn't always the case that Waterford had no patients on trolleys. So it took a lot of work. And I think that the key ingredient was teamwork between consultants, nurses and other specialists in the hospital. We had consultants who worked longer voluntarily, on shift, on call, maybe later than normal in terms of comparisons with other hospitals. That means decisions can be made quicker. We also made best use of the capacity that's there. But I think the other key ingredients were really good relationships with community services, so that very quickly, if patients needed step down and recovery beds, they were made available. And then there's an all year round, very constructive relationship with UPMC, which is a private hospital. And that was opened up through relationships, as I said, all year round, that could then treat public patients in some specialties. And I think the combination of all of those measures and good management, to be fair as well, has resulted in what's called a better patient experience time. So I've been saying to Stephen Donnelly and the head of the HSE that, yes, we need more investment in healthcare, and our budget that we launched will again set out ambitious, but I would argue realistic, investments which are needed to reduce the cost of healthcare and put capacity not just into acute but primary and community care. But we also have to be mandating that best practice and looking at what's happening in Waterford. It's very similar in Kilkenny. Drogheda has done very well in recent times as well. And then mandating that best practice across all hospitals. But equally, Donal, I'm conscious that there are particular problems in some rural areas. We know that hospitals like the one in your own area find it difficult to recruit staff. Remoteness is an issue. And there's also capacity constraints in hospitals, in some hospitals, that doesn't exist in others. So we're not always comparing like with like. And the job of a minister is to ensure that they make the investments which are necessary.
But the interesting thing is, a lot of what you were saying about what worked in Waterford does not seem to have involved extra investment. It doesn't seem to have involved extra money. It seems to have involved, if anything, imaginative thinking.
It was partly that, but there was additional investment. So we kind of got lucky before COVID, where there was a new wing that was opened up in Waterford. And it was for the first time we have a palliative care unit, which is really, really important. And the top three floors of that provided for 200 additional acute inpatient beds. And if you talk to hospital management, they say that was really, really useful during COVID because they were single isolation room beds. They were obviously really important during that time period. But now we're making best use of them at a time when, you know, there's huge pressures on the hospital. We had additional pressures with what happened with a fire in Wexford, as you know, last year, and University Hospital Waterford was stretched. But I'm conscious that there is good work being done in the hospital in Donegal. Staff are fatigued and they want to be supported. I don't at all call into question the management of the hospital. I'm very conscious after travelling to a whole range of hospitals, and I travelled to Donegal last year at the request of Piers Doherty and Pádraig McLoughlin and some of our councillors in Donegal, and we visited the hospital, we met with management, and I know that they are doing their best, but they have capacity constraints, partly to do with staffing and beds, and that's the point that we set out in our alternative budget.
And as we know, when we speak of capacity, obviously it's one thing to talk about beds, and as you said, the new wing in Waterford, 200 extra beds. Beds are one thing, but the real key here is actually the nursing, the backup, the ancillary, the domestic and the medical staff to actually ensure those beds can work. And that appears to be the problem in many hospitals, that maybe you can get physical beds in, but can you actually get the staff in and get the people in to actually service those beds?
Well, I think the recruitment of staff is probably the single biggest challenge now facing the health services. And that's why in our alternative budget, we set out a very, very detailed workforce plan. And I would argue possibly the best that has been produced to date in relation to what needs to be done and the scale of ambition. So I've met with anybody who is involved in this area, including senior people in the HSE and the department, but also people involved in training colleges. And there is the ability to very substantially ratchet up training capacity. That needs to be done because we need to be recruiting and retaining more healthcare professionals. I welcome the fact as well that we have a new public-only contract for consultants. I want to make sure that public hospitals are truly public and that we remove private healthcare once and for all from public hospitals. But my point is, if I was the Minister for Health, my job is to look at each and every hospital. What are the capacity deficits? What needs to be done to ensure that your hospital has the resources that it has as best we can over a number of years? And then it's up to management and staff then to make best use of those resources by using the best practices which exist in other hospitals. And that's the type of focus that I want to bring to healthcare. And I've been talking to the head of the HSE about exactly those ideas.
It's not at all beyond the realms of possibility that you could be health minister within the next 18 months. In the event that were to happen, are you confident that you can implement these measures? Because a lot of people will remember in the past, opposition health spokespersons had very interesting plans. I remember well, James Riley, when he was in opposition, had great plans in terms of the money following the patient, and he was going to reform and restructure the health service. And I think with all due respects to the man, it's fair to say he's not gone down in history as one of our better health ministers.
Well, my job is to make sure that we put forward the very best health plan that we can. So last Friday, I launched two documents, one which is a very substantial document which looked at the medium to long-term priorities that I have and what I would do if I was Minister for Health. And all of that is in preparation for an election manifesto and what we would hope if we do get a mandate, a programme for government. And then we launched our budget proposals, which is year one implementing those measures. I will spend the next number of months, and I gave that commitment to the 80 different groups that were in the room, which make up healthcare trade unions, advocate groups, patient groups. The proposals that I put forward went down very well. But what I said in the room, and I'll say it very publicly, I'm not going to put forward any measures which are not costed in the first instance, but not practical or realistic or deliverable. And I believe that there is huge potential in healthcare. I see it everywhere I go. There's huge innovation on the research side, but also, I think, on the front line in healthcare. And I want to be a minister that delivers an Irish National Health Service. I think it will take two terms in government, but I believe the heavy lifting can be done in year one, which is why our first term in government, which is why in our budget proposals this year, we provide for over €240 million of measures to reduce the cost of healthcare, which involves 400,000 additional medical cards, reducing the drug payment threshold from €80 to €50, which cuts the cost of medicines for all families, abolishing prescription charges. And that scale of investment would be needed year on year. So I can only be judged on what we do if we get our chance. And I completely understand that people are sceptical about whether or not we can ever fix the problems in healthcare. I can't allow myself to be a sceptic. I have to be constructive and positive and have a plan. And no doubt, like we've seen over the last number of weeks, challenges will present themselves and crises will happen, and you have to respond to them. But if you have a credible plan and you have a government and a finance minister, and Piers Doherty would be the finance minister, I would imagine, in the Sinn Féin government, then he has been very supportive of the plans that I put forward. But I can only be judged on it if we get our opportunity. And that's a big if. That's a matter for the electorate. And we're not presumptuous about the outcome of the next election.
Before I let you go, we've one query in from a caller. It's a point that's under discussion a lot at the moment. While reform of the health service is needed, our caller says, can you ask David Cullinan what his position is on Sinn Féin's gender recognition bill, which allows 16-year-olds to take parents to court to allow them change their gender, and proposes that children under 16 be allowed that right? Also, his position on children being allowed access to puberty-blocking medicines.
Well, that's not our position, and we don't support that. I did meet with specialists in the HSE who work in this area, and it is a very complex area and also a very emotive area. Those services in Ireland were suspended a number of months ago, and I think they are being reopened again or recommenced. There is a new strategy that's been looked at to support people who transition from all of the wider health supports that they need. That's going to be an expert-led, clinical-led review, and I support that. So in any of those areas, I will be led by clinicians and experts. And obviously, that's the best way to approach all of these issues. And I completely understand that the use of puberty blockers is controversial for some. It's very rarely used, and it's not something that I would want to see widely used at all. I think we need to make sure that all of the supports are there for children, including the psychological supports that children need, but any health supports in this wider area of transgender healthcare rights, in my view, has to be clinically led and expert led.
Deputy David Cullinan, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Deputy David Cullinan there. He is the Sinn Féin health spokesperson, and they've launched their alternative health budget. Now, before we go to a break, I want to read you a statement, because last week on the news, we spoke to Deputy Niall Blaney, who had been involved in meetings of Oireachtas members and the BPFI, the Banking Payments Federation of Ireland. And we understand that a proposal for allowing homeowners affected by defective blocks get some capital from the banks and special terms and conditions by which they can do so. A proposal at the moment is before both central bank and government, and we could have an announcement very, very shortly in terms of a what's been described as a targeted proposal and package. Now, over the course of the interview with Deputy Blaney after that meeting took place, it was listened to by members of the redress focus group banking and insurance. And as you know, there's a number of redress focus groups who have been looking at the defective block issues. And they've just sent us in a statement, update from the redress focus group banking and insurance. Since our inception in February 2023, the redress focus group banking and insurance has engaged in detailed discussions with the banking sector regarding the shortcomings of the defective block redress scheme. Despite various public statements from members of government about the need for mortgage providers to contribute to the solution, our group saw no evidence of adequate engagement with the banking sector to date. Our group has brought a fresh approach to discussions with the banking sector, focused on the issues created by defective blocks within the legally binding terms of conditions of our mortgage contracts. The banking sector, under the umbrella of the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland, BPFI, have entered into a positive process of engagement with us. The engagement is ongoing, and BPFI is coordinating its member banks in creating bespoke products and processes that are needed to address our issues. This process is ongoing. Nothing has been delivered as yet. Last week, the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland briefed members of the Oireachtas in relation to the current state of its work, and that is a consequence of engagement with our group of volunteer homeowners. Our group notes that in his comments on Highland Radio last week, Senator Niall Bainey failed to reference the key role our group has played in discussions on this matter to date. Members of our group have volunteered countless hours, including four separate trips to Dublin, to meet with the BPFI, Minister for Finance, the Oireachtas Finance Committee, and most recently on the 12th of September, we met with the Central Bank. It was incorrect of him to suggest that this initiative is yet to involve homeowners.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And you're welcome back to the show. 086 60 25000 for your texts or WhatsApp messages. 074 91 25000 if you want to call us. 0035 374 91 25000 if you're outside of the Donegal area. Now, yesterday we referenced figures which had been published showing that for the first time since 2007, the average national price of a three-bed semi-detached home has surpassed €300,000 after housing prices rose again in the last quarter. In many areas, house prices are now where they were pre the last slump, as it were. Now, Donegal, the average price is just over €150,000, which is about half the national average, and Donegal does have the lowest national price in the country. To discuss the figures and where we are at the moment in terms of the housing markets, let's go to Zoom and say good morning to Barry MacDonald, who is a director of REA, the Real Estate Alliance. Barry, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald. Thank you for having me on.
It is our pleasure. Barry, looking at these figures and what they're showing us, are you surprised that we are now at levels where we were, say, 10, 15 years ago during almost where we were at the last boom?
I suppose I'm not, because we've all read almost daily about the housing crisis that continues to plague our country. And the supply is the major issue. It's on the tips of the thumb of every estate agent around the country and every buyer around the country. And if I can just, Donald, give your listeners a bit of a background on how we compile our figures, it'll just give them an idea of what it's based on. So we're a group of independent estate agents right around the country. We've estate agents from up above in Donegal, right down to Kerry and across to Dublin. And what we do, we started this in 2013, where we go out to these agents. They're all active. They're all selling residential property right around the country. And we ask them a number of simple questions, but the main one being, what are you getting in your area for your average three-bed semi? And we've compiled that data along the way. And what's interesting about our survey is it's based on sale prices that they're getting right now. These questions were asked of our estate agents just last week, and we're publishing them this week. It's not based on guide prices. Anyone who's looked to buy a house in the last 10 years will tell you guide prices can be so misleading. It's not based on sold prices, because there's that time lag when, you know, published sold prices, it could be 2-3 months before you see what a house actually sold for. It's based on what we're agreeing deals for right now. So we found it to be, in our view, quite accurate as a kind of a yardstick of where the market is at the moment. And just this quarter, our headline figure is that the average three-bed semi is now in excess of 300,000, which reflects where it was, as you mentioned there, at the peak of the boom back in 2007 or 8.
In terms of the spread of REA agents around an area like Donegal, which is a mix of rural and urban, are you satisfied that you have sufficient branches serving sufficient markets that you can get an accurate overall view of a county, that it's not excessively rural or it's not excessively urban, if that makes sense?
It does, no, and I appreciate exactly where you're coming from. So our agents in Donegal, you know, we don't have a big number of agents right across the county, and this would be the situation right across the country. We don't claim that we're bang on the money. It's not a scientific assessment of where things are, but they are active agents. They do see what's happening on the ground. They are aware, and actually what they're also doing is they're talking to their competitors who might be, you know, 20 miles down the road active, we'll say, in the likes of Ballybuffet or somewhere, and they're talking to them about what's going on. And quite honestly, if you look at it, it generally tends to reflect what we're all reporting on 2 or 3 months later based on sale prices.
One of the questions that was asked of us yesterday when we initially referenced the figures when they were published was, what impact is the defective blocks crisis in Donegal having on the average prices in the country? One suggestion that the defective blocks crisis might be bringing down the price of housing in Donegal. The other suggestion was that because the defective blocks crisis may create a shortage of housing, it could actually have the opposite effect and may in fact increase the prices. Is there anything you can sort of say in terms of if there is an impact?
Well, there is, yeah, no. And I spoke to our agent in up in the Buncrana area, in Milford and Buncrana area, Paul McElhenney, about this issue. And he said, look, there's no doubt, you know, if you got a three-bed semi in good condition, we'll say maybe a newer house, it's certainly worth in excess of 200,000 if it's in the right location and good condition. But there's no doubt there are mica-affected properties or properties that are just in bad condition that are selling for 100,000 or even less. And that's clearly dragging down that number, that headline number of 157,000, which is quite stark. I think it's the lowest in the whole country.
It is.
But on the flip side of supply, supply is an issue right around the country. There's no doubt about it. I spoke to the agent all the way down in Kerry, and he the word he used for the supply problem is chronic. Buyers just cannot find houses. And the problem is they're just not building them. The value isn't there to build them. There is sporadic new build development going on in Donegal, but it's very, very minimal. It's down around Bundoran and it's down around Donegal town. And the rest of the county really has seen no new development at all, unless you might get the odd holiday home development one-offs and things like that. Where the value is there and it's worth the build cost.
So, I mean, the message really would be, if you're looking for a good three-bedroom semi somewhere like Letterkenny or Buncrana, don't necessarily expect to get it for 157,000.
Yeah, for sure. You're spot on there.
Yeah, I mean, and Donegal always would have been sort of bottom three. Usually Leitrim and Longford maybe would have been slightly less than Donegal in terms of prices in various surveys over the years. I haven't seen Donegal at the very bottom for a while, so we were just wondering if there was an impact. Sligo is an interesting one because it had the biggest increase in the country over the course of the last quarter.
Yeah, and I spoke to the agent in Sligo Town, Roger McCarrick, and he could tell us that that is really down to supply. There's no new developments, and for whatever reason, there's just pent-up demand in that particular area. I suppose, look, the wages are a major factor. Our agent in Donegal could tell us the wages on an average basis are just not as strong up in Donegal, so an affordability is a major issue for buyers, whereas in Sligo, they might be slightly better. And just for whatever reason, Sligo didn't see much increase in value over the last 2 years compared to other parts of the country. And then all of a sudden, it's just had a jump in the last 3 to 6 months, which has driven up their average prices.
The interesting thing is, even though we're talking about Donegal being the lowest in the country and at 157,000 compared to the national average of 300,000, the fact is the national rise in the last quarter was 0.6%. In Donegal, the actual rise was 3.4%. So even though it's the lowest in the country, it is increasing at a fairly more substantial rate than the national average.
And that was a trend we saw right across the country, to be quite honest with you, Donald. So, like, obviously, Dublin City is the biggest, you know, location market in the whole country. And Dublin actually, I suppose, Dublin had typically led the charge on price value increases over the last number of years. Like, we've seen increases in value, certainly since the start of COVID and maybe even before that. And every quarter we saw Dublin going up by a percentage more than the rest of the areas around the country that we assessed. However, Dublin's become a major problem. Affordability is just, it's beyond the reach of most first-time buyers. The average three-bed semi-detached house in Dublin is now clocking in at over €500,000. It's €504,000. And when you build in the interest rate rises we've seen over the last 12 to 18 months, it's just beyond the level of affordability for most young couples or individuals looking to buy a home.
We know that Donegal County Council is holding a special meeting next month to discuss the issue of housing and the supply of housing, social housing, obviously first and foremost it being the council, but the non-availability of private housing also raised, it being a contributory factor in more people now seeking social housing because of the non-availability and the supply situation in the private market. A lot of talk about trying to incentivise builders, incentivise construction, get more land banks open, get more houses built. What do you think is going to happen in the medium term, say the next 3 to 5 years nationally, in terms of are we going to see a huge increase in the number of new builds across the country? And an ancillary question then for Donegal, what impact is the ongoing redress scheme for defective block homes going to have in terms of the fact that many construction firms and builders are going to be tied up working on defective block issues and demolitions and rebuilds rather than actually building new homes? Could we see a situation develop where the rest of the country accelerates more than Donegal does in terms of the availability of new stock?
There is a risk of that. There's certainly no doubt, just to take the first part of that question, where values are lowest is where the biggest problem lies. You know, the market just isn't there for private home development, and we do need to look to the state to figure out a way that we can provide new housing stock to all areas of the country, not just around Dublin and maybe Cork and Galway, where the values are highest, but to look to more rural areas like Donegal and Leitrim and Longford and figure out how can we make the how can we provide a housing stock for, we'll say, our young first-time buyers who want to stay in those areas and build an active community. Dublin's not for everyone, you know, and we need to promote these kind of more rural lifestyles. And because of obviously remote working and connectivity and issues that have improved, you'd really like to see a situation where a level of housing is provided for those people. But unfortunately, looking to the private sector is not really the answer, because at an average value of, be it obviously the headline 157,000 or be it 200 or 225, it just doesn't stack up. The regulations and building requirements that are put in place there to build a new home, any builder would laugh at you. They'll tell you there's no chance they can build, be it a three-bed semi of 120 square metres for that kind of money. It just doesn't stack up. And as a result, any private development we're going to see are going to be in those areas where a house is worth certainly in excess of 300,000 at least. On the redress issue, the micro redress issue, yeah, I think that's going to tie up an awful lot of what happens in Donegal over the next number of years, as that hopefully gets somewhat sorted out. I think builders that have been active in the past will perhaps have their attention diverted to those issues going forward, and we just might see even less new development up there. But I think it's we have to look for state intervention in all aspects of that and of development of new homes.
Because the reality is this defective block issue is not going to be resolved this year or next. We're in a process that's going to be minimum 5 to 6 years and probably a lot longer.
It certainly would appear to be that way. Now, I know there's parties involved trying to work through things there, but I know many of your listeners are well aware of that whole situation, and really there's no quick fix, unfortunately.
In terms of the looking at the national situation, and Barry, you as director of the Real Estate Alliance have been sort of monitoring these trends now for a long time. Are we now in a situation where effectively we're going to move into a new housing boom and we're just going to restart the cycle? Or do you think the situation is going to regularise itself? Because as you say, on the one hand, you have unsustainably high prices in Dublin that people can't afford, and you have unsustainable low averages in Donegal that will just not incentivise builders or investors to actually become involved in the housing market. So you seem to have issues on both sides of the coin in terms of maintaining the situation where it stands.
Well, I really hope and think that we'll see a kind of a balancing out situation. And I want to be careful not to sound like some of the government politicians back at the peak of the boom who spoke about kind of soft landings and things like that. But it is a very different situation. You know, with demographic change, we're seeing a huge level of demand continue to be the case. I'm active in Dublin as an estate agent myself. And I'm active also down in Waterford. But in Dublin in particular, I'm based in the suburbs of Dublin, and we've seen exceptional levels of demand over the last 4 or 5 years there, and it hasn't stopped. I talk regularly to a particular friend of mine who's a very active mortgage broker, And he's obviously a little bit ahead in the chain as to people's thought process with regards buying. And he's telling me that that pipeline hasn't changed. The levels of we'll say, of agreements on mortgages is at an all-time high level, despite the mortgage interest rates increasing. And just people, I suppose, if you look at it, you have young couples. They want their own house. They're currently renting at exceptionally high levels of rent. They've all heard the horror stories of friends getting eviction notices and having to leave quite quickly. Or else there's people who are stuck at home and they want to move on with their lives. They want to get out of mum and dad's house and get their own place. So demand is still exceptionally strong. There is new development going on in places like Dublin. So I think you'll probably see, like our report this particular quarter, where we're seeing the regional areas increasing at a stronger rate than what we're seeing in Dublin. I think that will continue to be the trend. And I think we'll see a balancing out around the country. And certainly places that have a certain level of accessibility to Dublin will probably rise quicker than the more rural and with you know, inexpensive areas like Donegal and Leitrim and Longford, as we discussed. We might see more areas around the Midlands and the Dublin hinterland where they will increase and catch up a little bit with the likes of the capital city.
Finally, a question from a caller that on the one hand is a very short question, on the other hand could take up an entire programme. How would you go about valuing a mica or defective block affected house? Would it be effectively the site value less the cost of demolition? How would you go about valuing if someone were to put a house and declare this is a defective block house and put it on the market? How would you value that?
So we base, when it comes to residential property, typically we you know, it's quite an inexact science, the measure of valuation. It's opinion based, and often it's based on comparative to other properties that have sold of similar nature. Now, I've never had to value a mica affected property because of where I'm located. However, I have in the past had to value, we'll say, properties that were affected in other ways. And we were obviously aware of the situation that happened with the new developments back in 2005, yeah. 2006 and 2007 with the pyrite. And certainly that was an issue. And there was different ways of looking at it. You could look at site value. If obviously the cost to refurb what was there was too high, sometimes it makes more sense to knock and rebuild. And you counter in the cost of demolition, and then you look at what the site is left behind. In other cases, the cost to put the house right, if you like, isn't as high as a brand new build. And as a result, you just have to try and take that into account. But like I said, you know, no agent will tell you it's an exact science. And it is more often than not based on comparison. We might see a house up the road that's sold of similar size with a mica affection in a similar way. And you just compare it to what kind of appetite there was amongst buyers for that.
I suppose the big difference, really, sadly, is in the Donegal, Mayo and other county situation with the mica and other defective deleterious materials, it appears that demolition and rebuild is a lot more prevalent in this case than it was in the pyrite case. But Barry, we appreciate your comments. Barry McDonald, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Just want to let you know that the back road between Stranorder and Crossroads Village will be closed between Wednesday and Friday. That's tomorrow the 27th until Friday the 29th. The alternative route will be from Stranorder to Killigordon. So the back road between Stranorder and Crossroads Village will be closed between Wednesday and Friday, and you'll ask to use the route, just the main road there between Stranorder and Killigordon instead. Now, we have in the past discussed the dumping of tar on the outskirts of Duhurry, and it has sadly once again become an issue, and we're joined by Councillor Micheál Cholamgal-Osbach, who's been looking at this particular situation on Zoom. Micheál, a very good morning to you. Micheál, once again, tar dumped there at the Winamarv Heritage site. It's not the first time it's happened. You want to see this stopped?
No, unfortunately, it's not the first time it's happened. It's happened quite a lot. We've seen incidents there in the past where, unfortunately, the fantastic work that Coiste Forbairre na Duhurry are doing, not just in relation to the village centre itself, but on the outskirts of it, which this clearly is, where we were on radio not so long ago when, unfortunately, somebody decided to remove their sign. But here we are talking about this spot yet again in a very negative way instead of a positive way. It's anybody that knows it, it's either in the Duhurry, it's in Hohenlea, a very isolated area, a very beautiful, beautiful area. And it's one of my favourite areas, actually, that route. When you look back up at that gorgeous wee cottage that's up there with the red tin roof. But what we're experiencing is that some companies are coming along, need that be if they're out working for the council or else they're out doing private work, and they decide that the wee bit of tar is best dumped on our community, a beautiful part of the West Donegal. But unfortunately, we're not just talking about Na Dhuire, we're also talking about other areas that this has been happening for a very long time. When I was lucky enough in 2014 to get elected, it was one of the first issues that I started talking about, so much so that I remember one of the first roads in the parish of Anagra, that there was half a load of tar dumped over in Kincastle, which I reported immediately. I landed on site and the tar was still hot, and unfortunately nothing was done for it. It lay there for years, and at the time I felt very much so that it was a no scum and lum, who cares, position taken by certain people within the council about it. So I kept at it, because even if you look at other isolated spots like Cooley Nadigal on the way to Letterkenny, Liscannon, there's been quite a lot of dumping. But the council agreed that they would move in this. But instead of removing the tar, what they done was they broke it up and made it a barrier that nobody else could come into that area and dump on it. And it's the most unsightly thing ever, to be honest, which I was extremely embarrassed by it. But if you look around, and what I think it's really important is that this isn't just an isolated incident in Anrealtat in West Tyrconnell. It is also happening in other parts of the county, which needs to be identified. And I've asked at meetings that we would map out exactly where all this tar has been dumped. And granted, I'm not naive enough to think that the council has the resources to just go out in the morning and remove it. We don't, because the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael government badly underfunds our council. So, but we need to start a step-by-step programme to see this being removed. And I'd like to hear Donegal County Council, Cúirlechonda Gunningall, come on radio and talk this out with yourself or Greg, or preferably with myself, to hear what is their programme long-term to remove this here. We can't have two different policy where we have fantastic staff who are doing great work in regeneration programmes throughout our county, trying to help development. Cosha Farbraha developed villages and towns and adopting mileage and then paying them, but yet other sections of the council just ignoring it.
Should the council be providing areas where tar can be left across the county, areas which are not in scenic areas of scenic beauty, places that it would make sense that the tar can be put and maybe even reused?
Well, no, I would, sorry, Dylan, but I wouldn't agree with that at all. What I think what has to happen is that the companies that are involved in this or the individuals need to stop being self-centred and thinking of, sure, who cares? Let's dump it in this area. Sure, what matters? They need to take them back to the yard where they come from, let them do what they have to do by law and make it as environmentally correct as possible. But the idea of dumping tar on a community that has worked tirelessly to better it. Now, there are loads of people who are probably listening here now and are saying, geez, I could badly do with tar on my road, because there are hundreds of roads out there that unfortunately that we're never going to get through LIS. In my time anyway, because again of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's underfunding of that programme. And it's costing people quite a lot of money, because your car, your shocks, your bushings, and there's plenty of garages. Cousin of mine springs to mind who are thinking, say nothing, sure it's helping my business in a joking manner. But it is costing families. We're in a crisis, a living crisis caused by capitalism. We're putting further burden on families by not having proper roads, and we're putting further burden on the council by having to find the money to pick up this tar and dispose of it properly.
Well, maybe we'll get this conversation going with the council and see what happens in the meantime. Councillor Micheál,
And as just the last word, I just would like to give massive recognition to all the community groups out there, but especially the one we're particularly talking about who have done cartwheels. And if anybody finds themselves passing through Nidhuhuri, there's a fantastic wee shop there and a wee bar there.